Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is episode 8. By the way, Wild Trekker is a series of weekly 50-minute podcasts, a happening like dipping into a writer's notebook. Wild Trekker presents audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews, reflections, original plays, stories behind stories, jam sessions with musicians, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. Why don't you join me today as I explore an idea? The idea that time has a direction is actually moving somewhere. We constantly need to deal with time. Birth and growth, decay and death, hopes, expectations, fears, and finality. From hunters and gatherers to farmers, scribes, merchants, to women about to give birth, from military leaders and sailors to prophets, historians, philosophers, and astronomers, people have long struggled to understand the phenomenon of time. We may assume time has always been seen as an arrow pushing forward to the future, but that is far from the case. Actually, the forward movement of time is just one of several different time models over the ages. Now, the arrow of time is a powerful metaphor, so I've created soundscapes and have acquired the rights to licensed orchestral music to build for you the most compelling picture of this metaphor I possibly can. Since time immemorial, people have been fascinated, sometimes even obsessed, by the passage of time. We know that our life on Earth is a cycle beginning with birth and ending with death. There's no escaping that. But how are we connected to the rest of existence, whether before our birth or after our death? Is time relative or is it absolute? Does time itself have a direction? Does time push forward irreversibly from morning to night, from one day to the next? Does time thrust itself from past to present to future? Is there any way to reverse time, to go back to the past and make changes there? Does time follow a path, like an arrow shot from a bow? Can we anticipate that path by assuming the arrow will follow a particular direction and then land on its mark in the future? So where does time come from? One idea was developed in the 4th century BC by the Greek philosopher Plato in the dialogue Timaeus. Time, Plato writes, is a moving image of eternity. He means by this that God created nights and days, months and years, as well as the circular motions of the sun, the moon, and the 5 other stars or planets he knew about, so that humans could measure and distinguish motion and life itself. Plato's few words compress together an incredible number of ideas, from the dynamic nature of human time, to its place in the cosmos, to the power of the imagination. Plato wants here to be sure that his readers make a clear distinction between eternity, which is infinite or unending time, and the time we humans actually experience from day to day. So our time is real, but it's nothing but a pale shadow or a reflection of eternity, which is an ideal form placed somewhere beyond heaven. When we look at the ancient world, it's striking how many people did not see life according to the past, present, future model, as if time were pushing inexorably towards what is yet to come.
I'd like to mention several other models of time from the ancient world, which people used to understand change. The retrogressive time model, according to which time moves backwards. The circular time model, according to which time is like the outer edge of a cosmic wheel turning in the heavens, so that events situated on the outer edge of that wheel come round every 1,000 years and repeat themselves. The flux model, according to which everything is subject to continuous change. Every moment in time is unique. No moment is like any other, and it's practically impossible to seize or capture the moment. And finally, the Nemesis model, according to which a supernatural being, the goddess Nemesis, strikes down malevolent, scheming, and self-centered people with retribution. She reverses their good fortune because they don't deserve it. First, the retrogressive model. Sumer, the earliest known civilization in the Middle East, left no traces of myths pertaining to the future. The Sumerians took a pessimistic view of man and his future. They felt nostalgia for the secure old world they had known and whose traces were everywhere to be seen around them. They wanted to live a life free of fear, poverty, and war. But whereas they believed that long ago men and women had lived in a state of happiness, they couldn't believe in a better future. They considered it was impossible to see beyond the present into the future, since only the gods themselves could ever contemplate destiny. Time thus ended abruptly in the present. A similarly pessimistic view was held by the Egyptians, for whom the heroic achievements of the past were everywhere in evidence, but the future was a time of narrowing possibilities. In the 8th century BC, the Greek poet Hesiod wrote Works and Days. Here we find the powerful myth of the Golden Age, according to which 5 successive races have appeared on the face of the earth. With this poem, Hesiod seeks to change the ways of his mean-spirited and selfish brother by holding up the image of a happier society in the past, where justice was its own reward. The myth of the Golden Age is retrogressive. It symbolizes the gradual decay and fall of man from his godlike status in the beginning of time, and thus resembles the retrogressive view of time developed by other ancient peoples. The 5 successive races are as follows. First, the golden race lived like the gods and felt no sorrow, did not toil, but rather feasted gaily all the day long. Then followed the greatly decayed silver race, whose idleness, sin, and folly earned the scorn of the gods. Then came the bronze race, lovers of battle and honor. A 4th race of demigods, righteous and heroic, followed, and then came Hesiod's own 5th race. Dark is their plight, he writes, till and sorrow by day are theirs, and by night the anguish of death, and the gods afflict them and kill, and Zeus will smash them in turn on his chosen day. Eight centuries after Hesiod, the Latin poet Ovid gives a similar account of the creation of the world in the poem Metamorphoses. Well, actually, Metamorphoses is like a collection of poetic tales, all of which have to do with changes and transformation. In the beginning, writes Ovid, was the Golden Age, when men of their own accord, without threat of punishment, without laws, maintained good faith and did what was right. There were no penalties to be afraid of. No bronze tablets were erected, carrying threats of legal action. No crowd of wrongdoers, anxious for mercy, trembled before the face of their judge. Indeed, there were no judges. Men lived securely without them. But last of all, arose the Age of Hard Iron. Immediately, in this period which took its name from a base ore, all manner of crime broke out. Modesty, truth, and loyalty fled. Treachery and trickery took their place. Deceit and violence and criminal greed. Another example of the retrogressive time model is provided by the myth of Atlantis, which Plato developed in the Timaeus and the Critias. Plato here writes of an ideal commonwealth, the island of Atlantis, situated something like 9,300 years before his own time. The god of the sea, Poseidon, wisely inaugurates peace, prosperity, and a spirit of sharing on the island. Under his benevolent reign, the Atlantean people enjoy considerable wealth because of mines located on their island, as well as regular seaborne commerce. They have an abundance of wood, elephants, racehorses, pastures, grasses, and fruit-bearing trees. They build a beautiful city of palaces and temples, golden statues, canals, aqueducts, and every refinement known to man. But Plato develops this compelling vision of a long-lost wonderland from the perspective of the retrogressive view of time. The wonderland exists no longer. Plato says that the real problem the people of Atlantis have suffered is that they little by little lose their divine nature, their virtue, and fall into human desires and human vice to such an extent that they aggravate Zeus, the god of gods, who sees in what a woeful plight they have fallen. And although the dialogue ends abruptly, we are left to understand that Zeus inflicts severe punishment on the people of Atlantis. Other traditions maintain that the fabled city of 9,300 years before Plato's time is engulfed by the sea. You may wonder why I'm comparing the Golden Age of Hesiod and Ovid to the Atlantean myth of Plato. The Golden Age pictures the slow degeneration of humanity by means of a depressing succession of ever weaker races, whereas the myth of Atlantis situates a single primordial paradise in a remote past. What these various myths share, however, is the way they move in a backward direction, from worse to better, from present to past. They locate a blissful life free of want and suffering in a past which can be neither revisited nor recreated. We now come to the Greek philosopher Aristotle's idea of the eternal universe. In the 4th century BC, Aristotle is opposed to Plato's view that there's a beginning of all things, a specific moment in time when creation takes place. No, Aristotle says, time can't have a starting point the way Plato claims. On the contrary, the universe is eternal. And while the universe is subject to periods of change, that change comes around full circle once every 1,000 years, when the sun, moon, and planets return to the same positions they were in 1,000 years beforehand. As a result, future events are not just located in the future, nor are past events just located in the past. Events are both in the future and the past, since they're located on the outer edge of a giant cosmic wheel. Aristotle wonders, for example, whether the Trojan War, which happened in the 12th century BC, 6 centuries before his time, well, did the Trojan War actually occur before Aristotle's time? Are we to take it that the generation of the Trojan War is prior to ours, Aristotle asks, and that their predecessors are prior to them, and that those who are previous are prior ad infinitum? Or, if the universe has a beginning and a middle and an end, And if, when anybody is brought by old age to the terminus, he comes right back again to the starting point, then what stands in the way of our being closer to the starting point than the generations of the Trojan War were? Well, concludes Aristotle, if human history is a circle, and if a circle has no starting point and no terminus, it follows that the priority, which consists in being closer to the starting point, cannot be possessed either by us over the generation of the Trojan War, or by that generation over us. Well, what do you think of the idea of life being on a giant cosmic wheel? Once the wheel comes full circle, everything experienced 1,000 years ago will be reenacted exactly as it was a second time. And then, 1,000 years from now, it will be reenacted again, and so on and so forth. I'm not sure I would want to be around 1,000 years from now and have to relive some of the same experiences I've already had. Perhaps Aristotle means that someone else, exactly resembling us, would be around to relive those same experiences, which means they wouldn't be free to go off script. All the events of their life would actually be predetermined. Aristotle's theory goes to show how complex the idea of time really is. Another model from classical antiquity is the flux time model. In the 6th and 5th centuries BC, the Greek philosopher Heraclitus addresses continuous change in the universe. Only fragments of Heraclitus survive to this day. What we know of his writings are just a few sentences paraphrased by other philosophers. According to these fragments, all entities move and nothing remains still. We both step and do not step in the same rivers. We are and are not. In these cryptic fragments, Heraclitus compares time to the ceaseless movement of a river. If we consider the river to be a reality outside of ourselves, then that reality is continually changing. And in saying we are and are not, Heraclitus indicates that our internal reality is never the same either, from one moment to the next. Not that time moves downhill the way a river flows towards the sea. Heraclitus actually uses the river metaphor to show how everything changes and nothing remains still. You can't step twice into the same stream. Well, I live next to a river. If I form a picture in my mind of that river, whose stream flow changes from one day to the next and from one season to the next, I wonder whether the flux time model could include waves of time, currents, floods, and even drought. Heraclitus, after all, lived in Asia Minor, what is now Turkey, a place known for its cool, wet winters and hot, dry summers. Another model in antiquity is what I call the Nemesis time model. For the ancient Greeks, events are divinely ordained. Events occur by the will of the gods. One goddess in particular, the dark-faced winged goddess Nemesis, upholds justice by striking a balance between good fortune and the worth of the person enjoying that good fortune. She can't tolerate that evil or criminal or arrogant or insolent people go too far, that they glory in all the wealth and power and social status they have hoarded. So Nemesis strikes them down like a thunderclap. What do you think of these different models of time from antiquity? Do any experiences in your life support the idea that time is retrogressive or moving backwards? Do you find Aristotle's idea of circular time appealing, as if events were on a giant cosmic wheel, making a complete turn every 1,000 years? Or do you like the way Heraclitus uses the metaphor of the river to suggest that everything is in a state of flux? Perhaps you've seen malevolent people get their just deserts, as if the goddess Nemesis had finally knocked them off the crest of the wave of good fortune to make them tumble down into the trough of bad fortune. Which brings us to the Bible. The Jews of the Bible are a people focused on the future. Set against the backdrop of other models of time in the ancient world, such as the retrogressive, circular, flux, and nemesis models, it's clear the Hebrew Bible takes a very original approach to time. According to the Bible, time is moving forward from a unique past through a unique present to a unique culminating point in the future. The Bible is the first work presenting us with the arrow of time. Moreover, this arrow of time flies within the framework of a cosmic beginning and ending of time, an opening and closing of the phrase of life on earth. I consider this to be a biblical paradigm, which is, first of all, a Jewish intuition. Nobody else in antiquity even comes close to developing this view of time. Here's a reading from chapter 1 of the book of Genesis in the original Hebrew.
Hamisha Humshe Torah Sefer Bereshit Parashat Bereshit Bereshit Bara Elohim et Hashamayim ve et Haaretz ve Haaretz Hayeta Tohu Vavohu ve Hoshech al Pene Tehom ve Ruach Elohim Merahefet al Pene Hamayim.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day. Everywhere in the Bible, the human impulse to want to know the future is acknowledged. You may know this psalm, "Lord, let me know my end, and what is the measure of my days? Let me know how fleeting my life is. Behold, thou hast made my days a few handbreadths, and my lifetime is as nothing in thy sight. Surely every man stands as a mere breath. Surely man goes about as a shadow. Surely for naught are they in turmoil. Man heaps up and knows not who will gather. And now, Lord, for what do I wait? My hope is in thee." In the Bible, there are many different attempts to unlock the secrets of time and thus to model the future. Well, premonitory dreams can contain genuine communications from God about the future, the Bible tells us. But some dreams are false, and some dreamers deceitful. The Bible depicts kings who want to foresee the outcome of future battles. Well, that, after all, is their job. The problem is, kings are often subject to the errors of magic, divination, and sorcery. Whereas, if they consulted the real prophets, those prophets would be able to foretell events accurately for them. Events which radically interrupt the biblical arrow of time, such as the Babylonian captivity when the Hebrews are cast out of their homeland in Israel and exiled to a far land, modern-day Iraq. Well, these interruptions have the effect of challenging previous prophecies and frustrating expectations, and this upsets the human ordering or the human understanding of time. Frustrated expectations are often accompanied by impassioned end-of-the-world visions. The Bible thus establishes the forward movement of time within the framework of a cosmic beginning and ending. The biblical model of time leaves no room for belief in the circular model of time. I've noted already that a crucial element of biblical time is the belief in the existence of a future, which acts as the culmination point of time moving forward from the past and the present. This is the arrow of time. In the biblical context, the future is not directly knowable. God alone determines in advance what will happen and understands what he has done. God has pre-knowledge of each man and each woman from conception onwards. God has pre-knowledge of events. If the future is not directly knowable by man and woman, then it is at the very least accessible in varying degrees to the faithful, depending on the purity of their faith and the extent of their trust in God. Without faith and trust, there's simply no future whatever. Ultimately, biblical time is constructed around the future. The arrow of time serves as a focus for promise, hope, and deliverance from current suffering. The future is thus apprehended in a moral and allegorical way more than a literal way, and the prophet's message itself is a fiercely moral message, which doesn't necessarily have a strict, literal meaning. The early Christians saw the cosmic beginning and cosmic ending of time in much the same terms as the Jews, except that for Christians, Jesus Christ is the Messiah. After his first coming, his birth in Bethlehem some 2,000 years ago, his 33-year life in the Holy Land and his death and resurrection in Jerusalem, Christ will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead, and his kingdom will have no end. Christians thus look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. For Christians, biblical time is also constructed around the future. But the problem for some early Christians is knowing when the Messiah will return for the second coming. According to the New Testament, God has sealed a new covenant with the Christians, but this covenant is challenged when the Thessalonians demand that St. Paul write to tell them when Christ will appear at the end of the world. When will it happen? Well, if the world is going to end, the Thessalonians want to be ready. And Paul's reply is literally timeless. But as to the times and the seasons, he writes to the Thessalonians, you have no need to have anything written to you, for you yourselves know that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. This sounds to me like ambivalence about the much prophesied last things. Paul is not willing to commit himself to a particular date for the end of the world. The last book of the New Testament is the book of Revelation, or the Apocalypse. For Christians, the Apocalypse is the end-time scenario, closing the stream of revelations from God that start with the book of Genesis. On the Greek island of Patmos, in the Aegean Sea, St. John falls into a mystical rapture in a cave and receives a vision of secrets from heaven, revealing that Christ will return to the earth to judge the wicked and glorify the righteous. Here's a reading from the first chapter of the book of Revelation, or the Apocalypse, in the original Greek.
Αποκάλυψης Ιωάννου. Αποκάλυψης κεφάλαιων πρώτων. Αποκάλυψης Ιησού Χριστού, είναι εδώ και αυτό ο Θεός, δείξει της δούλης αυτού αδίγενέσθε εν τάχει, και εσήμανεν αποστήλας δια του αγγέλου αυτού το δούλο αυτού Ιωάννη, όσε μαρτύρησε των λόγων του Θεού και την μαρτυρίαν Ιησού Χριστού όσα είδε. Μακάριος ο αναγινώσκων και οι ακούοντες τους λόγους της προφητείας.
Blessed is he who reads aloud the words of the prophecy, and blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written therein, for the time is near. John, to the seven churches that are in Asia. I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is, and who was, and who is to come, the Almighty. Then John continues, I, John, your brother, who share with you in Jesus the tribulation and the kingdom and the patient endurance, was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, Write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches. Judgment Day will be terrifying because on that day, the last trumpets will summon souls before God, who will save the good and cast the evil into the eternal flames of hell. That's how many people in the early Christian church and many Christians in our own day picture the future. I mention St. John's Apocalypse here as an indication that Christians believe the biblical arrow of time points to the future, when there will be an end to all suffering and when Christ will inaugurate his future kingdom. I would like to change course here to mention an additional model of change, the cyclical time model. According to the dictionary, a cycle is a course or series of events or operations that recur regularly and usually lead back to the starting point. Now that may sound like Aristotle's great cosmic wheel to you as it turns in the heavens, but actually, the cyclical time model depicts, in the evolution of historical events and institutions, a pattern of change from birth and growth to decay and death. An early proponent of this cyclical time model is Polybius, a Greek historian of the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC, who detects a cyclical pattern in the organization of each political state. Well, he says, the cycle starts off as a primitive monarchy, then develops into a hereditary kingship, then the state declines into tyranny as a single all-powerful ruler seizes control. In opposition to this tyranny, the state then witnesses the emergence of a competing aristocracy of leading families who morph into an oligarchy of rich, powerful people who jealously hoard power for their own benefit. The oligarchy is replaced by a democracy or the rule of the people, which eventually collapses into mob rule. And you know what? It is at that point that this cycle starts again, and in the midst of mob rule emerges a primitive monarchy. The fact that Polybius sees the development of institutions and the organization of political states in cyclical terms means that some people today use the Polybius cyclical time model to forecast the decay and degeneration of individual states. I may come back to the cyclical model of time in another series of podcasts a few months from now, because many key thinkers, from Ibn Khaldun in Tunisia to Vico in Italy and Hegel to Marx in Germany, have worked on the same time model. Well, now I would like to make a little time shift here from the biblical arrow of time and the cyclical time model to the early 20th century. An interesting question for physicists is whether time is completely relative to the observer, whether it's just in our heads, or whether time actually moves in a particular direction. If time is symmetrical, then moving images of events would seem equally realistic if we played them forwards or backwards. But if time is asymmetrical, then time can only possibly follow a single direction, and that direction is forward. In the late 1920s, the British astronomer Sir Arthur Eddington addressed the issue of time. Arthur Eddington knew how to popularize science, making it more accessible to the masses. What happens when a spaceship pilot's speed approximates to the speed of light? Distances in the direction of flight become smaller and smaller until, for the speed of light, they shrink to zero. The spaceship pilot and the objects surrounding him shrink to two dimensions. We're saved the difficulty of imagining how the processes of life can go on in two dimensions because nothing goes on. Time is arrested altogether. This is the description according to the terrestrial observer. The spaceship pilot himself detects nothing unusual. He doesn't see that he's stopped moving. He's merely waiting for the next instant to come before making the next movement. And the mere fact that time is arrested means he doesn't perceive that the next instant is a long time coming. Well, we still aren't able to travel at the speed of light, but Arthur Eddington describes what it might seem like to become a paper-thin, two-dimensional spaceship pilot inside the spaceship, something like a playing card, say, the Jack of Hearts. That pilot would be unaware nothing was happening from the point of view of an observer on Earth and the time it stopped. Even more compelling is Arthur Eddington's statement about the arrow of time. According to the mid-19th century second law of thermodynamics, heat can never pass from a colder to a warmer body without some other change connected therewith occurring at the same time. This concept is called entropy, and it means that physical transformations work in one direction. From this concept of entropy, Arthur Eddington then develops the idea of the arrow of time. "Let us draw an arrow arbitrarily," he writes. "If, as we follow the arrow, we find more and more of the random element in the state of the world, then the arrow is pointing towards the future. If the random element decreases, the arrow points towards the past. That's the only distinction known to physics." Well, you have to wonder how the arrow of time can point either towards the past or the future. The modern-day physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking describes the arrow of time in a way which answers this question. "You may see a cup of tea fall off a table," says Stephen Hawking, "and break into pieces on the floor, but you'll never see the cup gather itself back together and jump back on the table. The increase of disorder or entropy is what distinguishes the past from the future, giving a direction to time." So here's the sound of a teacup smashing on the floor. Now, this is what a cup of tea smashing would sound like in reverse, as if, contrary to what Stephen Hawking says, we could actually make that teacup gather itself back together from pieces on the floor and jump back on the table, all of a piece. Here's the sound of a car accident. Here's the same car accident, but in reverse. So this is the way we could try to imagine reversing what Stephen Hawking says, to go from the future back to the past before the car accident happened. As much as we might want to avoid the cup of tea or the car smashing, or to return the smashed cup or smashed car to their original state, we can't. From this perspective, time moves one way and it moves to the future. But the real question for me is, why? In 2004, researchers at the University of Chicago published a fascinating paper in which they seek to explain the arrow of time in a continuously expanding universe. How, they ask, can the arrow of time have arisen from the natural initial conditions prevailing in the universe? Their answer is a hypothetical model they call spontaneous eternal inflation, which they derive as an extension of the Big Bang theory. People over thousands of years have been wrestling with the same questions according to the spiritual and intellectual knowledge they've had. That knowledge has evolved over time. Personally, I like the fragments from Heraclitus. Can we really dissociate our past experience from being and becoming as if they were distinct and mutually exclusive categories? Past, present, and future are all dimensions of one elastic and ever-changing unity. What already happened, what is currently happening, and what is still yet to happen are bound together. In other words, we are who we once were, and we become who we are.
I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that I sometimes acquire the rights to licensed orchestral music. But then, if you've already heard other Wild Trekker episodes, you will know that I've composed and performed some of the music for these podcasts myself, along with friends. Here now are Marc Harvey and Pascal Desmeules on electric guitars, with me, keeping time, on percussion. And here's Cameron Wallace on the tenor saxophone, with me on the piano. I composed this particular piece of music to evoke harmony. Harmony in the present moment. everything in its proper place, everyone doing well, and nothing to worry about. And there, after all this time, we're back to Montreal. Here we are in 2019. Next week, listen in to the second episode of my three-part series of podcasts devoted to the Arrow of Time. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, literary translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And Evidencia is spelled E-V-I-D-E-N-T-I-A, Evidencia. You can also drop me a line on the contact page on that website. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2019, George Toombs. All rights reserved. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Demel on the guitar. Let's get together soon. Bye for now.